Parshas Chayesara is all about, mostly about, the marriage of Yitzchak and Rivka. We know the story. Avram decides he needs to find a wife for his son Yitzchak, so he delegates the job to his trusted retainer, who is usually assumed to be Eliezer, although, as people have pointed out, Eliezer's name nowhere appears in the Parsha. The Avram's servant is referred to always as the Eved or the Ish, the servant or the man. Chazal say he was Eliezer. There would be different reasons for that. In terms of Pshat, the basic reason would be that in the end of Parshas Lech Lecha, the one time Eliezer appears by name, Avram says he has no children. He says, "U ben meshek besi, hu damesek Eliezer." The steward of my household, ben meshek besi, is Eliezer. And here, the protagonist of this story is described as Zikan beso hamoshel b'chol asher lo, the elder of his house, who was in charge of all his affairs. So it sounds like it was a similar position. It might have been years later, but I'll assume it was the same person. Perhaps they had a tradition to that effect or other evidence. In terms of Pshat, though, it's worth noting that the protagonist is not identified. Maybe we'll call him Eliezer sometimes just for convenience, and that's what Chazal say and Rashi says. So Avram sends his retainer to go find a wife. There's an elaborate story. Sichan Yafa Sichasan Shlav de Avos goes on for dozens of psukim. He finds Rivka, he brings her back. Yitzchak marries her, and they are very happy. It says that he married her by Yehaveha. He loved her, so the Radak says most men love their wives. That's not so significant. It must mean there was an exceptional love between them, so apparently this story had a very happy ending. And this narrative is often cited as a kind of model, as the kind of archetype for how Jewish courtship and marriage should go. The problem is, of course, that in a couple of parshias from now, in Parshas Vayetze, when it comes to Yaakov's marriage, we have a very different proceeding. Yaakov goes to a well, he finds a beautiful girl, he falls in love with her, he decides he wants to marry her, and years later he finally marries her, a much more familiar, much more modern, perhaps, arrangement. And I like to say sometimes the Torah sometimes serves, whether it should or it shouldn't, the Torah sometimes serves as a kind of Rorschach test. Sometimes the way you interpret the psukim says more about you and what you assume than it does about what the Torah is actually trying to tell you. If you begin by the assumption that the kind of old world arranged marriage way to go is correct, then you say that Parshas Chayesara is the ideal, and then you explain why Yaakov did it differently. He was on the run from Esav. It was less than ideal. Ruach HaKodesh, other things involved. You can go the other way, too. You can say that Yaakov was the normal way of doing things, and for some reason Yitzchak couldn't leave Eretz Canaan, other reasons why he couldn't find his wife himself. In any event, we have very different models of courtship, if you want to call it that, in marriage for Yitzchak and Yaakov. We don't actually know, as far as I know, we don't know how Avram met Sarah back in Haran there. I don't think we know anything about their early time together, so that doesn't tell us anything. It is worth noting, when it comes to Yaakov, both Rivka and Rachel are described as being extremely beautiful. It says about Rivka in this week's parasha of Hanara, Tovas Mara Mod, she was very attractive. It says about Rachel, of course, for Rachel Haisa, Yifas Tar, Yifas Mara, she was also very beautiful. The same thing is actually told to us about Sarah. It says when they went down to Egypt, so Avram says, "Now I know that you are Isha Yifas Marat." Also, all three, or three out of four, of the Imahos are described as being very beautiful. The men are not. The men are not described as being handsome. The men are described as being very rich. Avram has a lot of sheep and a lot of capital, and Yitzchak has a lot of sheep and a lot of capital. Yaakov has a lot of sheep. We find when he gave the presents to Esav, he talks about all the wealth that he has. This is a traditional kind of gendered thing that what women look for in men sometimes is wealth, and what men look for in women is beauty. The many notable women in Tanakh are described as beautiful, and it's hard to know exactly what that means, reflecting inner beauty perhaps, but there are Rishonim, for whatever it's worth, there are Rishonim who understand with regard to Yaakov. Avram and Yitzchak we don't know, but with regard to Yaakov, there are Rishonim who understand the psukim to pretty clearly indicate that he fell in love with her at least partially, or he decided to marry her at least partially because of her looks. It says, if you read the psukim in Parshas Vayetze, it says, "Vayne Leia Rakos," Leia's eyes were Rakos, hard to translate, tender, the art girl says. Commentators differ on whether that was an attractive feature, not attractive feature, but little bit obscure. Rachel haisa yifas tar v'yifas mara. Rachel was surpassingly beautiful. Vayahav Yaakov es Rachel. Yaakov loved Rachel. The psukim are one after another. We sometimes don't notice because Shlishi's right there. The first pasuk ends Sheni, and the next pasuk begins Shlishi. But both the Ralbag and the Radak understand that there is an implied connection here, that Yaakov chose Rachel, at least in part, because of her looks. Radak actually wonders why. He notes that in general we have a pattern in the Torah making a point of noting the beauty of the matriarchs and other women. He wants to know why. If they had, you know, presumably they had very pure intentions in marriage and all that, why was it important that their women be beautiful? They give various explanations. One of the Radak's explanations has a rather kind of Hasidish flavor to it. He says that having nice things make people happy, he says, and certainly a spouse who you're with all the time, he says, you have lots of simcha, tzarech sheyeh adam sameach ba'olamo, a person has to go through life with joy and happy with the portion that Hashem has given him. Hashem wants people to be happy, and Hashem causes tzaddikim to get things that are attractive, and so on. And that's why tzaddikim often merited beautiful wives. This reminds me of a wickedly funny comment of the Maril. Maril was a great halachist from 15th century Germany. Very, very businesslike, very technical, one of the founders of Minhag Ashkenaz. The Maril recounts a tradition. He says, this is an oral tradition probably going back centuries, but he says about Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, one of the greatest of all the Tosafists, one of the greatest German halachists, French halachists from several hundred years before that, from the 12th century or so. So Rabbeinu Tam was also very rich. Rabbeinu Tam was a successful businessman and was, besides being a legendary halachist, was also a successful businessman. So Maril recounts that when Rabbeinu Tam was studying a particularly difficult, dense sugya, dense Talmudic topic, he would instruct that a tray of his gold be brought before him because the sight of his wealth would broaden his mind and would put him in a good, expand his mind and put him in a good frame of mind for learning Torah well. And I guess the Radak is saying something similar about, and I don't mean to objectify the women, but he's saying something similar about having joy and being happy with one's lot is a good recipe for living life well. But the question is again, so Yitzchak and Rivka get married through this pretty much this arranged marriage type of thing, and Yaakov and Rachel very much do not. He goes to the well, he finds her, she's very attractive, he marries her, and so on. Incidentally, the Radak, when he describes the different phrases of Yifas Toar, Yifas Mara, so the Radak says in the first paragraph, he explains the difference in those phrases. He says, Toar is Turas Aponim, the shape of the face, the figure, he says. Mara refers to the coloring, he says. And he specifically says, Mara al Habasar Shayalavan, white skin, Ba'adam, and with red in it, Vasar Shachar, black hair. This was the traditional Sephardic Spanish beauty ideal. Some people like blondes. He says it was black hair. This is a common thing you find in the poetry of medieval Spain. You find kind of like the Snow White look. Hair black as ebony, you know, skin, you know, white as alabaster or red as whatever. So that was what the Radak says is ideal Mara. And that's Yaakov and Rachel. Incidentally, on the subject of courtship, I always like to relate. We find a few parashiyos later in the beginning of Shmos, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's a fugitive from Paro's justice after having struck down the Egyptian, it says Moshe went to Midian, Vayeshev al Be'er. He was in the vicinity of the well, and then he has the whole story with the daughters of Yisro who are being molested, being harassed by the other shepherds, and he gallantly saves them, and he winds up marrying eventually Tzipora. So Rashi brings a midrash. What was Moshe doing at the Be'er? So he knew that his ancestor Yaakov had found his mate at the Be'er, so he was at the Be'er too, and indeed he found his wife at the Be'er too. So when I was in eighth grade or so, this goes back to what I said before about Eliezer and the Eved, about Pshat versus Drash. I already had some kind of nascent interest in the study of Pshat as separated from Drash, so I had a Chumash test, and there was some question about what Moshe was doing at the Be'er. I don't remember if I forgot what Rashi said on the Midrash says, or I remembered it and wanted to make a point, or I was being a smart aleck. I don't remember exactly the context. But I answered, either in addition to Rashi or instead of Rashi, I answered, what was he doing at the Be'er? He had come from a long trip. He was stopping, you know, for a breather to get some water to meet the locals, and that's what he was doing at the Be'er. My Rebbe was not happy. The truth is, you know, that as you'd expect, there are commentators that do say more or less that. The Rashbam I saw this morning says that. The Rashbam says he stopped at the bear, kadam ha'amid lafush, like a person stops to get, to rest, to catch his breath. But the Midrash, as it often does, imputes greater significance, and he says, in some sense, he was echoing what had happened to his ancestor Yaakov. So regarding the basic courtship question, the question of, you know, what does Judaism typically say about the ideal way to get married, arranged marriage, dating that we do, and so on. So the truth is, we're going to discuss some of the actual halakhic literature on point. There is some discussion of how people got married. We can also look, obviously, to history, how Jews did get married. And this is a tricky topic, especially when we don't have a lot of halakhic sources. We never really know what we have. Even if we can document historically how Jews did things, we don't really know to what extent that was an authentic, inherently Jewish way to do things, and to what extent that was just the way society did things, and Jews did things in the same way. Our ancestors probably got married through engaged marriages much more than we do today, and probably their non-Jewish host cultures also probably relied on arranged marriages much more than they do today, and it's always difficult to untangle exactly who was influenced by whom and to what extent we're dealing with inherently Jewish values as opposed to just cultural, general cultural values that change with time. But we'll try to at least pull out from some of the rabbinic sources, Talmud and post-Talmudic sources, A, what Jews actually did, and B, what the halacha actually has to say about this. So the discussion really revolves primarily around a sugya in Kedushin. Maseches Kedushin, beginning of the second parak, Ish Mekadesh, which is basically about the ceremony and forms of marriage. So the Mishnah says, the very first Mishnah of the second parak, it says, Ha'ish Mekadesh bo bishlucho, a man can perform Kedushin, the giving of the ring, himself or via an agent. He can designate an agent. Ha'isha Miskadesh es bo bishlucha. A woman, likewise, can accept Kedushin either directly from the man or via her agent, or her agent from his agent. Any combination thereof is fine. Pretty much universally today, agents are not used. We virtually always do every marriage I've seen or heard of. Certainly the Kedushin has been performed directly between the husband and wife, but technically you can use an agent. You can use an agent, and in Talmudic times, there is some indication that they sometimes did, although it's virtually unheard of today. So certainly when you're dealing with two adults, there has to be consent. The Kedushin can only be performed by the spouses themselves or by agents that they voluntarily designate. So yes, both sides have to agree to the Kedushin and agree to whatever agent they want to use. And yes, though the one exception is, we'll discuss soon, the one exception has to do with minors. In certain cases, parents have the authority to perform Kedushin for minors. We'll touch on that a little more soon, but certainly with adults, you need consent and you need designated agency and so on. Incidentally, we mentioned Kedushin we'll discuss this in a little more detail later. Kedushin is the handing over the ring. Today we do it as part of the whole marriage ceremony with the chuppah and the badekin and the ichud, everything together. It used to be done separately, more about that later, hopefully. But I say ring. Today, Kedushin, certainly in Ashkenazic circles, and I think even more generally in most Sephardic circles, Kedushin is typically done with a ring. Anyone who has studied the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch will know that ring is not really mentioned specifically as the item of Kedushin. The Talmud simply stipulates that something of value be given, de minimis value, a pruta is enough, which is on the order of a penny, order of magnitude of a penny or so, less even possibly. So there are certain rules the Talmud gives about making sure that the value is clear. We don't want to use things that require shuma, that require appraisal. That's why we give a very simple gold band without ornamentation or gems or so on generally. But where the ring comes from is not clear. It's, again, pretty widespread today. Not clear if it's a Jewish custom in particular. Obviously, there are those who try to explain it, try to give Jewish symbolism to it. But it's far from clear whether that was something we invented or simply borrowed from the non-Jews. Similarly, things like the color of wedding gowns is white. You know, I always like to remark that on Tisha B'Av, in several of the keynotes, we refer to kalos who are dressed in scarlet, kalos levusha shani. Not sure, not sure where the white comes from. You can obviously explain it in using Jewish values, but it's not clear where that comes from. But in any event, so Kedushin is the act where something is given from the groom to the bride. It can be done, the Mishnah says, either directly or either of them or both can appoint agents and perform the Kedushin like that. Now, the Gemara infers from the language of the Mishnah that even though agency is technically permitted, it is not ideal. It is preferable to you to do it directly. Why? Why is it preferable for both sides to perform the Kiddushin directly? So the Gemara gives a couple of reasons. One reason is because it's a mitzvah, and like any other mitzvah, there is an advantage in performing a mitzvah yourself. The Gemara gives examples of certain rabbis of the Talmud who did the Shabbos preparations. They did some of the cooking themselves, even though they had servants or other people could have done it, because it's a mitzvah to do mitzvahs yourself directly. The other reason, though, the Talmud gives is it's more than a mitzvah. There's a question of iser. There's a question of actually doing something wrong if you designate an agent. The Gemara says, Asur la'adam she'ikadesh es'isha ad she'irena. It is prohibited to marry a woman sight unseen. Shema yiraba davar maguna v'tisganala. Maybe when you see her, she won't appeal to you. And rachman amar brachu recha kamocha. That will be a bad thing. It'll lead to shalom bayis problems. It'll lead to friction and bad feeling between them. Therefore, that is not a good thing. The Gemara calls it an iser, actually. It is prohibited from contracting a marriage, from performing kedushin, without seeing the other spouse. Now, obviously, we might think that if you know the woman, even if you can still do it via shliach, and indeed, that is the language of the Torah. The Beis Yosef points this out. If they've met before, and they know each other, and he decides, for whatever reason, to do the kedushin via an agent, that might be okay. But the point of this Gemara is that you should not, it's aser even, it's not clear whether this is absolutely aser, like eating milk and meat together, or it's just not recommended, but the Talmud does use the word aser. It is aser to marry a woman sight unseen. One passage in the Talmud. Talmud goes on. Talmud says that a father has the right to contract marriage, kedushin, on behalf of his minor daughter. Technically, even when she is slightly above her majority, she becomes an adult in halacha at bas mitzvah, at 12 roughly. There's a six-month period from her 12th birthday where she's considered a nara, which is kind of an in-between stage between minor and adult. In terms of mitzvahs, she actually has all the mitzvahs, but for certain halakhic purposes, she's still in her father's domain, father's jurisdiction to some extent, and one of the consequences of that is the father can actually accept kedushin for her. So until she's about 12 and a half, the father can accept kedushin, and she has no say in the matter. She has, regardless of whether she knows about it, doesn't know about it, objects, does not object, the father has the halakhic authority to accept kedushin. This is, again, virtually unheard of today, except in certain pathological circumstances. It is virtually unheard of today. However, technically, he has the right to do that. And the Talmud says, again, the language of the Mishnah implies that it is wrong, certainly wrong to do it when she's a minor, until she's an adult and she can express an opinion. Again, the point is you should not do it without her consent as an adult, as a halakhic adult at least, which is 12. Talmud says, again, this is a reference to the principle, again, asur, it is prohibited to marry your daughter when she's a minor. Achatigdal v'tomer v'ploni anirotze, she has to be old enough to express a preference, to express consent, and say, this is the one I want to marry. Why the Torah gave the father the right to do it, if it's going to be asur, I don't know, but that's what the Talmud says. We'll have a suggestion in a minute, but it is asur, in general, for him to do this, even if she's young, if she says that doesn't mean anything, she has to reach her adulthood, which again, in halacha is bas mitzvah, and then she says, ploni ani rotze. Incidentally, this is alluded to by the Ralbag, finds a reference to this in this week's parasha. Again, it says in the end of the story of Yitzchak and Rivka, it says, after they're all impressed by how God has brought the whole thing to apparently a very smooth conclusion, so Eliezer says, let me take Rivka and go. So it says her brother and her mother said, not so fast, let's let her stay with us a little bit. And then she'll go. Eliezer said, no, I want to go now. So they said, all right, let's ask her. Her brother and mother, Lavan, I guess, her mother, I don't know if we know her name, Nikra Lanara of Initial Espia, let's ask Rivka what she wants to do. They said, Rivka, what do you want to do? Do you want to go now or not? And she said, hey, Lich, I want to go. And indeed she went, and that's the rest of the parsha. So the Ralbag says, this idea of asking Rivka, it's always interesting how we learn halacha from people like the family of Bezuel and Lavan, but this is a reference to the idea that a girl should be consulted before she is married. Now again, Rivka, according to the Midrash at least, was quite young, was a minor. So I don't know if he means this in a completely rigorous halachic way, but the Ralbag does say that in general, this is in the last paragraph for number two, he says, Ein roi lahasi isha im lo ladaita v'rtzona. Not appropriate to marry a woman, even if you have the legal right to, without her consent. Kilo yos lachricha, it's not appropriate to do that. It can lead to bad shalom bayis, and so on. That's why they asked her. Again, it's a little interesting. It doesn't say they asked her originally before saying, great, you can have her. They only asked her when he said now, and they said, let's wait a year or so. Then they asked her as a means to stall, but nevertheless, the basic point of the Ralbag is the point of this Gemara that we do not, it is generally usur, it is generally against the ideals of the Torah to marry off a young girl, even if you have the right to do so, without asking her. Now, we find, going as far back as the medieval period, these one or both of these halachos were ignored. The custom in among the Balei Tosfos in medieval France and Germany was that they did marry off their girls when they were minors. This point is acknowledged, documented, and raised by Tosfos. Tosfos on this Gemara in Kedushin notes the fact, Achshav, he says, in his time, our custom is we marry off our daughters even when they are minors. Why do we do that? The Gemara explicitly says we can't. This is one of these examples you find. Most of Tosfos tends to be, you know, internal analyses of the conflicting Gemaras and understanding Gemaras. Every now and then you find a Tosfos whose goal is to reconcile contemporary practice with what seems to be a clear Talmudic position. This is one of them, where he kind of acknowledges that contemporary practice did not seem to be consistent with the Talmud. So he says, the reason is because the galus, the difficulty of the diaspora gets worse every day. And if a person has a dowry today, he may not have one tomorrow. And then the daughter will be stuck without a husband. And therefore, if you have the opportunity now, you need to do it right away. A lot to unpack here. Tosfos assumes that dowries were critical to getting the girls married off, that the dowry was kind of the sine qua non for getting her married. And because economic instability and economic inflation or depression or economic just chaos in general was so bad, if a person had the chance to marry a girl off today, he had the money for it, he might not have the money tomorrow, and therefore, you know, carpe diem, just go for it, and it's, you know, this overrides the concern of the Talmud. A similar, although somewhat different, point is made by the Mordechai. The Mordechai also discusses the fact, also brings earlier medieval sources discussing the fact that in their culture, in the Franco-German culture of the Tosafists, they did not follow this dictum of the Talmud. And he also wants to know why. So first he brings some opinions of Rabbeinu Tam and others that perhaps Halacha actually does not follow this Gemara. Most poskim assume that it does, but some Rishonim suggest we don't paskin like this Gemara. But in addition, he brings from Rabbeinu Eliyahu, a contemporary of Rabbeinu Tam, I think, that we are, in terms of demographics, we are few in number, mu'uteam, v'chashina and penikadmenu acher. Again, if you don't grab her today, someone else will grab her first. The competition is so fierce. Again, the fact that they're demographically small, as long as the men and women are kind of in proportion, not sure why that should be such a problem, but basically this is some kind of medieval version of what people like to call the shidduch crisis today. It was apparently hard to find a shidduch, according to the first sheet of Tosfos, because of dowry problems, according to the Mordechai, had to do with numbers somehow, although again, I don't know exactly how the arithmetic works out, but somehow there were so few, it was so hard to find shidduchim, so it was... Again, they were so desperate that they felt that these were reasons to override the rule of the Talmud. So again, we know that historically in the medieval period, we have, you know, several independent sources of this point that they ignored this Gemara. Exactly why is not clear. A couple of reasons having to do with the desperate situation, but we know that this halacha was not widely followed. Now, beginning several hundred years later, beginning with the 16th and then 17th century in Poland and the Ashkenazi communities and the Achronim, we find discussion of the other half of the Gemara. The fact that this has to do with marrying off minors. The other half of the Gemara is marrying off women without meeting them, arranged marriages to the extreme where they don't even meet beforehand, before the marriage. So a number of the Achronim around the turn of the 17th century begin to wonder why they were ignoring that halacha too. Why they were, I don't know if they were still marrying minors or not, but the other halakha in the Gemara, arranging marriages without the couple meeting each other, this was apparently being done in Ashkenazic circles. And they raised the question of why. It seems to be, again, against the Talmudic rule. This was first raised by the Drisha, of Yeshua Falk, the author of the Sma, the Prisha, and the Drisha. He says, Anu Nagim, our custom is, in Shidduchim, couples get engaged, Ruba deruba, the vast majority of times, they're done by a shadchan, they're arranged by a matchmaker, the chassan does not see her at all. So he says this is because this is only shidduchim. It's true, we arrange the marriage, we set up the engagement before they meet, but they meet at the wedding, they meet before the actual wedding takes place. This is amplified upon by the Sefer Beis Hillel. Sefer Beis Hillel says that there was a tradition known as the chassan mal. So chassan means what it sounds. Chassan, mal, also means what it sounds like, meal in German or Yiddish. This is a tradition. It is not common today, at least not in circles in which I move. that there is a meal, kind of like a rehearsal dinner, some kind of meal the night before the wedding. There would be a family meal. I don't know if friends were invited, where the chassan and the kala, the family would be there. They would have some kind of pre-wedding celebration. They would meet at this meal. Now, I don't know the historical research. I don't know how far back this goes. And echoing what I said earlier, I don't know if this was a uniquely Jewish custom or if this paralleled some other European custom of the time. But there was apparently this ancient custom going back at least 400 or 500 years that there was a chassan mul that was celebrated the night before the wedding. I Googled it very quickly just to see what people have to say about chassan mul. So as I said, I don't think it's common today in most circles. Chassidim, apparently some Chassidim still do it. If the Google's hits result in things like the chassan mul of the Rebbe's, of the son of the Rebbe of so-and-so and the daughter of the Rebbe of so-and-so and so on. Most of YouTube videos of them and articles about them. They seem to be mostly, the custom today seems to be mostly in Hasidic circles, but back then, 400 or 500 years ago, it's represented as a standard, taken for granted custom in Ashkenazic circles, Poland or Germany. Yes?
So we have a custom that the bride and groom don't see each other first.
Yes, excellent point. We'll get to that momentarily. So the Beit Hillel says this chassan mul satisfies the requirement that the chassan and kala meet. They've met before the wedding. They met the night before the wedding. They got to know each other a little bit. They talked. It was kind of like a date, except there were lots of other people around also. And this satisfies the requirement of the Talmud. Now, the Nitzei Gavriel, a Hasidisha and very much a traditionalist who is very sympathetic to Hasidic and traditional sources, nevertheless cites a couple of later sources, Hasidic sources, other sources, who are not really happy with this approach. They say, what's the whole idea that we want the chassan kala to meet before they marry? Because in case they don't like each other, we don't want the marriage to go forward. So this meeting has to occur before they're really committed, certainly before the marriage takes place, but also before they're committed. If you have an engagement that's gone on for several months, and there was certainly in the European cultures, there was a formal tnaim, and there were penalties for breaking the engagement, and there was a cheirum for breaking the engagement, and it was the night before the wedding, and everything's been printed up, and the meal's there, and it is very, very difficult for economic reasons, for social reasons. They used to pay a knas for breaking an engagement, and the poskim say the reason is because of the humiliation that one side causes the other by jilting them. It was an averit to break an engagement like this. So the pressure for economic reasons, for social reasons, for halachic reasons is so great not to break off the engagement the night before. To say that this satisfies the requirement, he doesn't really have a choice. Some achronim say that's not really good enough. You really have to meet at least once or twice. You have to meet a couple of dates before any level of commitment, before any point really of difficult or no return has been met. Nevertheless, the Beis Hillel thought this was enough. He said that's the whole point of the chassan mul. Minhag Yisrael Tari says that's probably why we have this meal, to give them the chance to satisfy the Gemara, that they should meet before the wedding. Now, you mentioned, Zora mentioned, the custom not to meet before the wedding at all until at the wedding itself. This is a very interesting custom. As some of you probably know, there is little or no source for this in written halachic literature, little or no source for this custom before about 50 to 100 years ago. Not documented certainly in Shulchan Aruch or even in all the works that have been written on marriage. Until 50, 75 years ago, there's no record of this. The reason is unclear. It is widespread, almost universal depends on the culture, but in most circles in which I have moved in my life, it is virtually universal. However, again, nobody knows where it comes from. Nobody knows exactly what the reason is. When I was preparing this talk, I came across an article by one of those, usually very good, and this one is no exception, one of those myth debunking articles by Rabbi Dr. Zivotofsky, What's the Truth About? This was, I think, an early one before he had the What's the Truth About title, where also he brings numerous sources from contemporary Rabbanim who basically said that acknowledge it has no real source, so that it wasn't, it's relatively new. He brings from Rav Soloveitchik, something like that. My father always told me that from Rav Soloveitchik. People asked him about the minhag. He's like, what minhag, he said. But there were also some rabbis who accepted it, but the facts are that there is no documented source for the custom before about 50 or 75 years ago, and the reasons for the custom are also exceedingly unclear. We do find, again, of the sources we do have, it is clear, not only is there no source for the custom, it is also clear that the custom, at least in some circles, is not in effect. So, for example, we have a comment of the Rama in Shulchan Aruch, citing Bali Tosfos, again, citing medieval Ashkenazic sources, for example, citing the Agudah, number 9, Aguda, which was a medieval Ashkenazic work, he said, Nimtza b'shem gedolim, some gedolim have said, that an engaged couple shouldn't live together in the same home. Not because it's aser, but because familiarity breeds contempt, shiakutsu zebezeh, they're going to get sick of each other. Why that doesn't happen after the marriage is an important question, but it's not healthy. It's not healthy for them to live together. So again, live together on an ongoing basis is not recommended. Still not aser, not recommended. Nothing about a period of time that it's absolutely aser. We do find there was some cultures in which it was uncommon. There's a comment to the Marashtam, the last thing on the page. He mentions in passing, it's not the point of his tshuva, he mentions that the custom of Ashkenazim was that they typically didn't meet at all during their engagement. Again, it doesn't say it's a halacha, it doesn't say it was... But there were certainly cultures where they met less than we do today, but there is no reference anywhere in the halachic literature to that they shouldn't meet at all for any point before the wedding. Furthermore, shortly before I got married, I think I spoke at one of my offer for something. I actually, the theme of my talk was I made a whole list of menhagim that are commonly practiced in weddings today that have little or no source in the earlier poskim. I discussed not meeting before the wedding. Another one I discussed was there is, again, this maybe is not as widespread, but it was very common in my circles, that the chasan and kala, if they were to meet for a weekend, Shabbos, they were typically not put up in the same home. Let's say if the Kala was visiting the Chassan, she wouldn't stay with his parents, she'd stay down the block somewhere else. Some of that is just convenience, you know, privacy, she wants her own space. But I think for Tzniut's reasons, it was common that they didn't do that. And again, there is no source for that. What we have the Ramos is they shouldn't live together on a steady, ongoing basis because it's not healthy. But the idea that they can't, you know, spend a weekend together, you have to avoid Yichud, obviously. You have to avoid Yichud problems. But as long as you avoid those, there is no basis for the idea that they can't, you know, spend a weekend under the same roof. But yeah, so there is this minhag, but again, this chasan mal seems to be either an exception to the minhag or evidence that the minhag was not practiced in that time. But that's what they did, that they had this chasan mal, which was interpreted by some as an implementation of the halacha that they should meet before the wedding. Now, on a related topic, so the Gemara says that you can't do kedushin before you see her. Poskim were saying they used to do Shidduchim before they saw her, and they said that's okay because it was still before the Kedushin. And again, some Achronim object because they said you can't really back out. Realistically, you can't back out at that point. It's difficult to back out at that point. This takes us to another topic, which is that in traditional halakhic literature, and I think more than that, in traditional Jewish literature in general, we have the term Kedushin or Erusin. In the Torah, we have the phrase Nara Hamarasa a number of times. Erusin, along with the terms Arus and Arusa, for the two parties to an Erusin, Erusin means Kedushin. Kedushin is the giving of the ring. Today we do it under the chuppah as part of the whole marriage ceremony. Back then, in Talmudic times, they used to separate the two. They would first have Kedushin, which was giving the ring or the item of value, whatever it was. Then there would be a delay period of 12 months, commonly for a young girl, or less, for less sometimes, but there would be a period of a delay for about a year while the woman assembled her trousseau and got ready for the marriage, and so on. Then they would get married, then they would have Nisuin, which is very unclear what Nisuin is. It's either the chuppah, or the badekin, or the ichud, or going home together. That would be the Nisuin, and during the whole period of the Erusin, they would not live together. They would live separately. She was formally married. If she committed adultery, that was adultery, capital crime. But they didn't live together, and living together began at the Nisuin. Today we do everything together. Today is, again, virtually universal to do everything together. Kedushin under the chuppah. Almost always, Rav Henkin talks about a certain culture which was not done like that, but certainly today it is, again, virtually universal to do Kedushin and Nisuin together. Now, in modern Hebrew, the term Erusin is used to mean engagement. What we call in the U.S. here engagement, in modern Hebrew they call Erusin. I remember a couple of months ago, an old friend of mine from Israel, he moves in Haredi circles, but this is not limited, I think, to Haredim. He sent me an email. He said, Mazel Tov, his daughter, who I knew as a two-year-old or so, had gotten engaged. He said, L'chaim is tonight, Erusin is Thursday or something. So I forwarded the email to my wife, and her hair stood on end. She said, Erusin? People are doing Erusin today? I said, no. Today, they misused the word Erusin to mean engagement or engagement party, vart, we would say here in the U.S., but no, they're not actually doing Erusin. So the truth is, I use the word misuse, the truth is there's actually some lively contemporary discussion about the legitimacy of using terms like erusin to refer to engagement. The several achronim, including Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and others, feel that it is a misuse of the word, and not just a misuse, which could be harmless, but it's a potentially halachically problematic misuse of the words. The halacha is that if we have reason to believe, even if it's not firmly documented, even if there isn't formal testimony, if we have reason to believe a strong rumor that a woman has accepted kedushin, in some cases we require a get. It's a pretty serious business. So there's an elaborate sugyas in the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, about kol, about rumors, what's considered a solid rumor to be choshish for. But some poskim felt that we really should not use words like erusin to refer to an engaged couple, because it's a misuse of the word. You're referring to them as married. If the engagement, chas v'shalom, breaks off, you might need a get. You should really stay away from them. And the truth is, halachically, b'di'evit, it's not such a big deal. One of the first poskim to address this question actually was the Rush, about 800 years ago. The Rush was asked basically this exact question. He was asked about an engaged couple, and the engagement eventually broke off. And the question was whether she needed a get. There were some rumors that kedushin had taken place. Again, it's virtually unheard of today to do kedushin outside the chasana. Back then, it was sometimes done, and they were choshish for it. So there were technical questions in the Rush's case about whether there was any real reason to believe that kedushin had taken place, and the Rush ruled no, there was no reason to believe it, the woman does not need a get. One of the arguments that had been advanced for why the woman should need a get was because people were referring to her as Ruvain's Arusa, Ruvain's fiancé. Says the Rush, nope, she doesn't need a get. Because even though it is true, the Rush concedes, that in halachic literature, in biblical Hebrew, in formal correct usage, it is true, the Rush agrees, erusin means married. However, in the vernacular, he says, in spoken language, it's an idiom that simply means engaged. Therefore, we do not require a get. And obviously today, they've decided that they use erusin to mean engaged. So la halacha b'di'eved, it's probably not a concern. Doesn't take away from the fact that some poskim might still feel, why get into that? It's better not to use the word. But nevertheless, b'di'eved, this really goes back to a tshuva of the Rush, that you wouldn't really, you probably wouldn't require a get. Once got into an argument with some people online. I was, just as a linguistic purist kind of, I was bemoaning the fact that they've misused the word today, erusin, to refer to engagement. I said, you know, for 2,000 years, the word has had a concrete and definite meaning, and I didn't understand why they were misusing it today. So someone said, well, we need a word for engagement. So what other word do we have? So I said, for 2,000 years, we've been using the word shidduchim to mean engagement. Mostly that's a medieval and later usage, but it does have roots in the Talmud, going back 1,500 years or so at least. So the Talmud does occasionally use the word shadich or shadichi to refer to engagement. So I said, there's a perfectly fine word that means engagement. You want to use the word that means engagement, we have a nice word for you, shidduchim. Might not be biblical, it's not clear what the etymology of the word is, but certainly it is, it's an old, authentic Jewish word. You want a word, I have a very nice word for you. So they told me, that shidduch smacks of, you know, old world European fiddler on the roof, and we want something, you know, we want something a little that's, you know, a little more modern. So the truth is, in general, I'm no expert on language, but in general, I think there is a strong preference in modern Hebrew. They've preferred biblical language over rabbinic. I don't know if shidduch is really a biblical word. They do like using biblical words wherever possible. You know, we can attribute different motives to that. I'm not really an expert on modern Israeli history, or, you know, I suspect that people have said there's a little bit of a nefarious motive. You know, biblical Judaism is bold and colorful and romantic and sovereign, and rabbinic Judaism is gullus and Torah Shebaal Peh and a lot of Jewish history, and that's obviously not an attitude I have much sympathy for. But be that as it may, modern Hebrew has decided, and even among Haredim, that they use the word erusin to refer to simple engagement, even though that is a technical misuse of the word. I know language evolves and so on, and at some point it becomes a legitimate use of the word. As a matter of fact, I read an article very quickly by Rabbi Hamburger, the expert on Minhag Ashkenaz, where he says that even in rabbinic literature, erusin is used often to refer to, erusin has become a word used to mean engagement. That surprised me. I don't think that's correct. The few sources that I've seen who discuss it acknowledge that in formal, correct writing and rabbinic writing, certainly it has never had that use, and it was only a vernacular use, whether in the time of the Rush or today. But be that as it may, it certainly has become an accepted use today to use erusin to refer to engagement, arus, arusa, and so on. And the effort, I don't think, will cause problems. We also find in the Achronim that they also point out that Chasam Kala really traditionally should be used to refer to a just married couple, a newlywed couple. They are Chasam Kala at the wedding, from the wedding for a few days, Shav Brachas, whatever it is. But again, we often use the term during the engagement. Once again, the Achronim say, Chalch Mechokek, Beis Shmuel, they say that if people refer to an engaged couple as Chasam Kala, they don't require a get because we don't require a get because everyone knows that the terms are just used loosely today to refer to that kind of thing, but it doesn't mean that anyone's actually suspecting that they're engaged.